Hello and welcome to another CG Garage podcast. This is episode number 33 featuring Justin Denton. Gina, we have some announcements to make coming up very quickly now.
Yes. SIGGRAPH is here.
The website is...
Oh yeah, it's up.
Okay, which is SIGGRAPH2015.chaosgroup.com.
Yes.
Go check it out. There's lots of stuff in there. In fact, we were talking about the fact that you guys should know by now that it's booth 807 where we're going to be there. And we're going to be doing V-Ray Days in room...
510?
510. Lots of people are coming. There's still maybe one announcement or two, but we have most of the roster for V-Ray Days. Includes people that have actually, several people have been on this podcast, but they're really cool people. So why don't you tell us some of the people that are on there, Gina?
Sure. We just added, or we're about to add, by the time you listen to this podcast, Ben West.
Yep.
And we've talked about and heard from Rory Robinson on this podcast.
Yes.
And we've got Kevin Bailey from Atomic Fiction.
Yep.
Kevin Margo. And one of Justin Denton, who is on this podcast today.
Yes, he's going to be on this podcast, and we'll talk about that quickly. And then, of course, Kevin Margo. So the three Kevins will be there.
And Kevin Sears.
Kevin Sears from Method. That's right.
Yes.
So Kevin Sears, Kevin Margo, and Kevin Bailey.
Correct.
And Miguel, who is also really cool.
Yes, Miguel Ortega.
And we haven't done a podcast with him yet, but he's really cool. We did a little video with him, so you guys may remember that. We got some product announcements we're going to do. And we're also going to be doing this thing called the VR Bar, which is going to be this virtual reality demos that we're going to be doing. Several of those demos are going to be done by the guys at Legend 3D, which includes Justin Denton, who is on this podcast. And that is basically what we talk about a lot in this podcast, is about VR, their experiences in that, how they've gone through that process, how they've evolved their techniques, and what they're doing out there. They're doing some really amazing content. Mm-hmm. So definitely check out what's going on there. All right, guys, hope you like it.
See you at SIGGRAPH.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
What do you guys use this screen for? Is this also like a review area? Or?
We do it. Well, we...
What was that?
Watch Netflix.
Like the truth comes out. I love it.
Yeah. Friday, what did we watch? Terminator on it? Yeah, we watched Terminator on it.
The first Terminator. Okay.
Because you remember the old school effects were like that much better, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that very first version of Arnold was fantastic. The head replacement.
Yeah, it was so much better when it was practical effects.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. What's funny is Spaz Williams was how I got my start on that project.
There's nothing wrong with that.
It was really cool,
but all his arguments is like, oh, it's so much better in the old school and was practical. It's like, to a point.
Oh, we romanticize big time. It's kind of sad.
Well, in my mind, it looked a lot better.
Yeah.
It did. This is the last time I looked at it.
Well, it's just like all these articles that are coming out lately talking about how like VFX are ridiculous and like.
That's exactly why we watched it. We watched it because we wanted to say, okay, that well. 3D Pro thread, yeah.
Oh, really? It was that thread. Oh, that's fantastic. Are you on 3D Pro too?
Yeah.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll keep an eye out for you now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Steven with a PH.
Yeah, I have.
So, yeah, it's cool. All right, so I've actually already started a podcast. I may actually include the whole Arnold thing on the podcast.
Totally fine, man. To be clear, I did not get my start on Terminator. I got my start because of Spaz.
Because of Spaz. And yeah, Spaz is cool. Yeah. Spaz is over. He's at IOM still, right?
No.
What happened?
Spaz has a fascinating story with that stuff. I don't know everything, but look up Band from the Ranch.
Oh, was he one of those guys?
He was a part of that group.
So he was Orphanage and all that stuff?
Nope. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll, yeah. I'll, all right.
I will not speak out of place on that one.
Okay.
Though, so.
Maybe I should have him on the podcast.
Oh, he would be fucking amazing
really?
On the podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've had Scott Ross. He told me some stories.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No. And Spaz will not hold back any punches.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. All right. Well, this is already a great start to the podcast. I already have a hint as to the next one.
There you go.
Okay. All right. So here, let's go back, because there's actually some stuff that people should realize. Why I even decided we need to talk to each other. We talked to each other through a mutual friend, Mark Allen.
Correct.
And Mark is telling me about some stuff you guys are doing, some VR stuff. I was like, all right, well, everyone's doing VR stuff.
Right.
But I was interested in hearing it. And then when the more I heard it, it's like the content you guys are doing is pretty cool. And you guys are making content. There's a lot of stuff that's being made mm-hmm. in a really interesting way. But you actually come... The company you work for is Legend 3D.
Correct.
And I'll let you tell me a little bit about what they do, but you actually come from a background that's different than what Legend 3D is known for, right? You haven't sort of evolved for that. You were brought in for a new medium.
Correct.
So let's go ahead and tell me about what Legend 3D is and what this new medium is and how you got involved in that.
Sure. So Legend 3D is actually a 2D to 3D conversion house.
Mm-hmm.
They've been doing conversion, I believe, since 2000, 2001, something like that. So
sure.
For quite a while. They got their start through Barry Sanders, who was part of Legend Conversion before that, which was doing color conversion. So they were the ones that were doing like those old black and white films, and they were converting them to color. He had written a ton of software and done some programming, you know, and really created this way of doing color for old black and white films.
Sure.
Some people love that stuff. Some people hate it.
Yep.
What's funny on the side of all of that was that apparently when they went and redid a lot of these original black and white scans from these prints, is we realized that our ability to scan them got much better, and there was actually nudity in a lot of these old films we didn't know had nudity. And so they also had to paint those things out, like
really?
Nipples through sheer cloth and things like that, which is kind of this funny little just side benefit of getting better prints.
Yeah.
Well, I would call it a benefit. Some people wouldn't.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, even back in the... I watch a lot of some old films, and I was watching a old W.C. Field film, and the raunchiness in those movies in the 30s was unbelievable.
Yeah.
The amount of blatant opium use that was being filmed and talked about in was incredible. I mean, there's a shot of Cab Calloway singing a song called "A Reefer Man." And W.C. Fields walks out in some kind of a, you know, Asian garb with a massive opium pipe, smoking the opium pipe during a musical number. And I was like, wow, they could never do that today. And this was back in the 1930s. So I think that, you know, that kind of thing has changed a lot. But what's interesting, okay, so sorry, go back to technology.
Sure.
So... colorizing films.
Yep.
Let's talk about that briefly. That involves basically a way to massively roto things over a long amount of stuff.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah. It's what they call regioning.
And regioning.
So,
okay.
Yeah. You know, typical roto, how most of us think from, like, say, the VFX perspective, is you're rotoing the object that you need to isolate.
Okay.
Whereas when it comes to colorization and then further doing conversion is actually based on needing to do that for everything in the scene. So you're actually creating a region for parts of the background, parts of the foreground, middle ground, your hero subject, whatever parts you need to take care of as far as colorization. And then they realized that was already directly applied to how you would do stereo conversion.
Okay.
So these are kind of earlier days of conversion. So it's kind of, say, the maybe it's the dirty word side of conversion where people
thought
of
about
it as...
Let's talk about why it started off as a dirty word.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you know, this was the day when it was kind of like the paper cutout version of conversion, where you would see very obviously the object in the foreground that felt like it was on a single plane in front of you.
Right.
And then you'd have your actor in another plane, and then you'd have the background behind them. It was almost a moving pop-up book.
Pop-up book is exactly the analogy I was going to use. Okay.
Go ahead. And so that's where it started, and that's what I think a lot of people still sometimes think of with conversion.
Mm-hmm.
But what ended up happening was you know, these are very smart people that were doing this, and they realized that before it ever even hit the audiences that this needs to improve and get better and better and better.
Okay.
And so they started to detail out these regions to the point of where we are now, which is that even the bridge of a nose gets a region, one nostril gets a region, an eyelid versus the eye versus a reflection in, say, your glasses, Chris, would get a region.
Right.
So that's where they are now, where everything, you know, a single hair, and with one of the things that I love about Jared Sandrew, our CCO, he actually says no hair left behind. Like that's his motto for it, to the point that, you know, we're not going to roto off like somebody's flyaway hairs. They're actually going to get their own shape and going to get their own definition and in effect get their own depth because of that. So now the tip of your nose is closer to the audience than your cheek versus your eye versus your ear. And so now they're actually using that to create a depth map.
Right.
And it's got actual volume. So we're not in the days of that being flat anymore at all.
Okay.
This is detailed to that point now.
Uh-huh.
That being said, I won't overspeak on any of these things because I'll be honest, this is not what I do at Legend at all, which is kind of what you were getting into.
Yeah, you got brought in for a different thing because I think what they started to see is the power that they have to do conversion is not just to dimensionalize stuff, right?
Correct.
Is the term dimensionalized used anymore?
It's kind of funny. Everybody seems to kind of get their own buzzwords depending on which conversion house you're talking to.
Sure.
But dimensionalizing is definitely still used. It's usually, you know, called like giving it depth.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So they realized that they could use this for something else. And so tell them the story about how you came on board then.
Sure. So before I came on, they started to know that they were interested in VR. And that came more from a creative point as opposed to like what the company's actually capable of.
Okay.
And that has a lot to do with just, I'll speak about Jared Sandrew again, good personal friend. He's actually the reason why I'm at Legend.
Uh-huh.
I worked with him at various facilities throughout the years. He worked at the orphanage for a long time.
Okay.
And he also, I worked with him at this tiny boutique VFX house called Engine Room VFX in Hollywood. And basically, he knew that some of the things they were doing would apply to VR. But the main thing is he wanted to get into VR, so he was finding ways that it would work for them. So one of the things that any conversion house has to do, and especially Legend, what they do is they clean plate a shot. So, you know, if you're going to take a person and make them bounce off of the background, then you have to create the pixels behind them for the left and the right eye.
Right. So whatever's occluding behind, you have to
correct.
Fill it in. Right?
Correct. And one of the unique things that they do there is they don't create one eye off of the other. So, like, let's say you have a shot of a person, they don't actually create the left eye off of the right eye or declare that it's one eye. They actually call that the center eye, and they create a left and a right eye from that eye so the perspective stays proper.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which a lot of people don't know about that part.
Right. So usually, they would just say, okay, we're just going to call it all right eye and we'll just make the left eye.
Yeah, because I mean, let's be honest, it sounds like the simple thing to do.
Right.
But the reality is you're going to have to create the same number of pixels either way.
Right.
And if you're only having to create, say, 2 or 3 pixels on the left side of someone's head and on the right side of them, depending on which eye you're on versus a full 6 pixels on another side,
right,
it's going to be a lot more believable if you're only filling in less pixels per eye.
Side. Yep.
Exactly. And so knowing that they had to already do this clean plating effect, they knew that they already knew how to create information that's not there.
Sure.
And that played directly into the VR side of things with, we have to create these stitches of these cameras. And so the interest initially was in live action.
Okay.
Which I think that's important to kind of state that now, because it wouldn't really make that much of a difference for VR that's, say, full CG.
Right.
But for live action VR, right now everybody's using these multi-camera solutions. Like you have Jaunt. I believe they're at like 16 cameras for theirs.
Mm-hmm.
You have the Hero 360 rigs, which we've used a couple of their rigs already, that are at 6 cameras and 7 cameras, and they even go up to their stereo versions that are like 12 and 14 cameras.
Okay.
But the reality is you're going to have to stitch those cameras together. And we haven't seen, you know, anything that automatically stitches everything together perfectly yet. But we already have a workforce that is designed around adding information that's not there or correcting information that's been made incorrect by bad stereo.
Okay.
So we have all these artists that are already ready to add pixels that will look correct and that you can't tell that an artist put their hands on it.
Okay.
Because their whole thing is to convert these 2D films to 3D films in a way that you don't know whether they were shot 3D or not.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's how good conversion has gotten, just as an industry. It's completely changed.
Yeah, and on top
of
that, I'm sure that the directors eventually love it because, like, oh, great, I don't have to deal with the filming in 3D anymore, right?
Yeah, and that's...
Because it's much more liberating and freer to do it with a single camera.
It absolutely is. There are pluses and minuses to that, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
The pluses are exactly what you just stated, also mixed with, you know, we have some in-house tools that I've shown you, actually, that where you can actually affect how much stereo is there. You can take an actor and put them closer to you or further away right there live, just like a color DI session through our Mystica sessions. So that's something that we provide as a service, as a company. But I will say there are a couple of negatives for sure. Whether or not those affect VR as much as they do live action, film is a different kind of question.
Okay.
Film, you know, you want to shoot certain ways for stereo. You know,
of course.
Certain types of camera movements can be a bit nauseating in stereo.
Yep.
You know, big, giant, sweeping pan moves can be a little bit hard on the eyes, over the shoulders, depending on how you're doing them.
Right.
Like, today's filmmakers in general like to do dirty overs, which for those who don't know what a dirty over is, it's basically a really close over the shoulder where you're catching like the corner of the person.
Yeah,
you're supposed
to get like an ear that's completely out of focus, but you see that.
Yeah, like a standard over actually works quite well in stereo and actually just creates this nice little like framed image for you.
Yep.
But a dirty over at times, depending on how deep the image, can be a little bit jarring. So, you know, those certain kinds of things like that can be a little bit hard as far as like stereo for film.
Yeah.
But we're running into completely different issues as far as like stereo for VR.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll get back onto the topic just a little bit here. So, you know, we ended up getting this project, and this was before I came on, which was called The Recruit.
Okay.
And what had happened is the piece had been shot with 2 3-ality rigs.
And so this was supposed to be a VR shoot, right?
Correct. Yeah, this is a full VR project.
And it's a live action.
That's correct.
And so and it's done with these two cameras. So tell me about how these cameras were set up.
Correct. Yeah, so it was basically a dual 3-ality rig. So 3-ality, they typically use RED cameras. I think they're set up for Alexa now too, if I'm correct. But they set it up where you had two cameras facing forward, standard stereo type of a rig, you know, shooting into a prism kind of a thing.
Right.
But then they also did two cameras on top of it angled upwards.
Okay.
Yeah, and so they shot the talent like that. And they shot all their other plates like that forward. And then they did 90 degrees to the left, 90 degrees more backwards, so 180 degrees from the original.
Right. And they shot it after it already been shot?
Correct. Yeah. So yeah, no, same shoot days,
but
while you're shooting the
actors.
Not
at the same time.
So this one, the talent stays directly in that forward, like 90 degrees area.
Right.
So,
but it also basically means that you can't move the camera because you got to shoot all the other ones after the action's already shot.
Correct. Yeah, this is a lock-off shoot. Lock-off in the sense of the forward plate.
Right.
And then we would shoot the other ones. But what we ended up learning when they provided us the plates is that they didn't stitch together that well.
Okay.
So that's not to take anything away from the filmmakers. You know, it's one of those things where we were all experimenting at that time, trying to learn, you know, what works best.
It was an interesting idea, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And let's be honest, we're all going to try things until they work or they don't work.
Right.
And, you know, they still shot great plates.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were able to stitch them together as a single eye, and then we did a conversion process on those.
Which is kind of the cool thing, because basically you guys know how to convert, right?
So, correct.
So that's the thing that you're able to do is like, okay, we can make a sphere. Basically, you've had a 360 spherical image, which is a standard thing that a lot of people did, but it's obviously all moving, et cetera, and you're able to add depth to that in post.
Correct. So what we've done is kind of took the exact workflow that already applies to film and then just had to figure out how to apply it to VR. And
right. And we should explain a little bit about the difference between a VR in film and a VR – I'm sorry, a stereo in film and a stereo in VR. Because when you turn – if your eyes are pointing in front of you, right? So you have your two cameras this way. When you look to the right, your eyes – as you move your head, your eyes have to move with each have to rotate around that same thing, right?
Correct.
So you have to be stereo. And you can't just have it for – basically, it has to be stereo all the way across. So that means that each pixel has to move – as you're going around the circle, you have to offset each eye independent of each other. Makes for an unusual stereo problem, right?
It really does. And what's interesting is that, you know, stereo pairs work that way even for standard film, but they don't work that way all at the same time.
Right.
And that's where the challenge comes in, is that this is simultaneous. So it's right. Almost a next gen version of slit scan rendering.
Exactly. So each slit to represent, you have a slit for the left eye, slit for the right eye, slit for like, so every
correct.
Little, and you can almost do it down to every pixel, which is basically what we can do in CG.
And to even get beyond the concept of pixels, it's vector based.
Right.
Like, that's really where we're at with this, is that it's about the vector that your eye is for literally that pixel.
Right.
Yeah, so there are pixels involved, but obviously we want to go way beyond where we are with resolution.
Absolutely.
With VR, so it's actually way more about just the vector in a 360 space.
Exactly, okay.
Yeah.
So that was a good learning experience, and that was your first foray into saying, okay, we now know that we can take a non-stereo live-action plate, mm-hmm. convert it, and make it a stereo VR experience, right?
Correct.
And that was the beginning of that process, which is great.
Yeah, and I think the biggest things we took away from that were somewhat learning curve creatively, but a lot of it was pipeline-oriented. It's like,
sure.
Okay, how do you deal with 60 frames per second
in
a high-res pipeline? Because we were finishing this piece at 4K.
Okay.
And so for VR, that means 4096 by 2048.
Right.
So we're at 4K by 2K at 60 frames per second, which is pretty aggressive for most people's pipelines.
Yes. Yeah, it is. So now, okay, so you're challenging now. You're 4K, Yeah, these are complicated problems, which are great. But I love the idea of what it could mean in terms of what you've discovered through that process. And it's like, okay, now I know that. But really, by you realizing that, okay, well, I've just liberated myself of the stereo problem,
right?
In terms of shooting,
right?
So now I can make a lot more lightweight cameras, as long as I can get a 360. I'll be able to deal with the other problem on my own post, right? And you give, like you said, you can give yourself more freedom. You can give depth after the fact, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So what? What? How did this? Can you tell us a little bit about the pieces and how it worked, or sort of the creative behind it?
I mean, again, I won't speak too much on the creative, just because I learned about the pipeline of it after the fact.
Sure.
I didn't work on the project myself. So,
right.
The biggest things that like kind of. We had to deal with it weren't just the things I've mentioned already, but also that we did have to add some rudimentary VFX into it. So
okay.
I can talk about the piece because it is on Gear VR, so you can watch it on Milk VR for anybody who's listening.
Oh, great.
So yeah, so it is available on Milk VR.
The Recruit.
It's called The Recruit,
okay.
Correct. So it is available that way. It's not on, I don't believe they've put it on YouTube 360
okay.
or any of the other players, but I'm positive it's on Milk VR.
Okay.
But one of the things that we had to do was, even though our main actress is sitting right in front of you at this table,
mm-hmm.
it is a locked off camera. So you stay where you are, but you don't stay where you are because the environment actually changes around you.
Right.
So that's kind of one of the things that we had to figure out is, okay, how do we make it where, you know, they stay there and we transform ourselves into a new place.
Right.
And, you know, for a standard film shoot, you're like, oh, yeah, no problem. You guys obviously already know how to do roto. You roto them out, or you
exactly.
shoot them on green screen and you're done. Well, that wasn't the case. We shot them actually on the first set you see, which is inside of a room. So they're
mm-hmm.
actually there in that location. And then we rotoed them out of that and add the other locations. So you end up in a forest for part of it.
Yep.
You end up in kind of like a really high-end house apartment for another part
right.
of it. And then I won't take away what happens at the end, but you
right.
do end up in a very high altitude location,
right.
I will say. But we also wanted to kind of tip our hat to the fact that you're in a VR space.
Right.
And so there is this piece where you see them kind of glitch out, and you'll see our main interviewer, I'll say, she's in more than one location at once in front
okay.
of you. So we actually comp her in and add a little bit of a digital effect. So it sort of it's sort of one of those kind of tipping your hat to the fact that you're in VR, mm-hmm. But kind of playing with you as an audience and messing right. with you a little bit, which I thought was a really neat way of doing
yeah, it. Yeah, it is cool. But I think, I mean, just the whole process of it, it's like, how do I cop? How do I do an effect? How do I do this? And so it's, and we can talk about this later, but this whole thing is a learning experience for everyone on the creative side, on the technology side, on everything, sort of trying to figure out, let's try this, let's try that. And so this was a cool idea. It's like, okay, can we actually take these cameras and we can shoot it the way we want to? And then that didn't necessarily work. But at the same time, you were able to salvage the project. Well, I don't want to say salvage, but you're able to make the project work because it's like, well, we're just going to convert it, and that's what we do.
Yeah.
So that's a really cool idea. But also now, like I said, it's like you've now liberated yourself by saying, I can make a much simpler camera rig, which led to your next big project.
Yeah. Before I move on to the next one, I got one last little thing I want to mention about that piece, which was there is one part that I think was like kind of the tell for us of like where we can go, mm-hmm. Which is our main 3D artist on it, Ryan Cummins. The table itself that you're sitting at the whole time mm-hmm. never got close enough to you as a viewer. And so we added the rest of the table in CG.
Oh, okay.
Nobody knows that. Like, that's one of the cool things. Like, nobody realizes that little bit. And we did that because it just wasn't close enough to you as a viewer. And that's actually a really big challenge of shooting like VR for live action mm-hmm. is that it's very hard to tell where you are in relationship to things when you're looking at a 360 or what we call a lat long image, the mm-hmm. full unwrapped version.
Right.
And we ended up adding more of that table just so it felt like you were actually sitting there. And when I came on board, when that artist walked me through that and he said, hey, you know, I added this, I was like, that's what we need to be doing right there.
Right.
And so that was really what kind of springboarded us into our ideas for the next project.
Okay, go ahead. So tell us about that.
Sure. So the next project we did was called Be the Bee. It's Art of Patron.
Okay.
So it's for Patron Tequila.
Yep.
So, you know, nothing better than mixing VR and booze.
That's right.
A great idea.
Yep. And flying
And flying, yes. So it's the perfect combination of all the things that mm-hmm. everybody wants out of a VR project. Mm-hmm. So what ended up happening was that we had a director, Mark Kudzi, come to us and actually came to Jared Sandrew again, our CCO. And he came to Jared, and then Jared introduced Mark to me. And just so you know, Mark Kudzi, high-end commercial director. He had directed Katy Perry's Roar video and has done some things for Apple and Nintendo, I believe. So definitely like a rising star in kind of the commercial directing world.
Sure.
And Mark had not done a VR project yet, and so he knew he needed to talk to some people just to get his pitch ready.
Right.
And so he said, hey, guys, I've got this project that this agency out of New York, Firstborn, which they're an amazing commercial agency, by the way.
Okay.
So look their stuff up. They're pretty awesome.
Yeah.
He had come to us and said, hey, I want to put this pitch together. Do you guys mind like coming with me to the pitch?
Uh-huh.
And so we talked to him about what our process would be. So he came into the office. I kind of gave him some of the same spiel I gave you about just like how I feel about like where we're going to go with VR and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he really latched on to the idea of doing it conversion-based.
Okay.
Which to me is awesome because it took us a while to convince people, I think, that conversion was the way to go for 3D film. Mm-hmm. But we're so new in the VR space that I don't think it's going to be quite as difficult because you talk to a director about the fact that, like you said, you don't have to worry about those things while you're on set.
Right.
You just focus on telling your story and we'll mm-hmm. dial in the stereo after the fact and we're cutting down on the overall workload on
exactly.
you. So, you know, we actually basically talked to the studio, talked to Firstborn with Mark Kudzi about how we would do the conversion for it and uh-huh. everything else. So kind of had to just educate them a little bit on how that would work. And they had already done a couple of stereo projects for VR. They had actually done the Mountain Dew skateboarding piece.
Oh, okay.
And they've since gone on and done, I believe they did the snowboarding one through them as well. And then they did this one with us.
Okay.
So the idea is that you are a bee that flies through an agave field all the way through the process of making Patron through the Patron distillery.
Okay. And so you basically are going to have to like miniaturize the viewer, right?
Absolutely.
And have them fly.
Yep.
and do that. And you want to shoot the majority of it, if not all of it, in live action.
Correct.
So you used a drone, I'm assuming, to do that, right?
Yes.
Okay, so, go ahead.
Yeah, so basically what we did is we pitched the idea of shooting it on a drone and possibly using things like Flycam, which is actually what Justin Lin did his help project with.
Okay.
Was actually, I think he did Spider-Cam, but it's a type of Flycam.
Okay.
So we talked to them about that and also potentially using an RC car for some other moves that are interior. And then lucky enough, working with Patron was amazing because obviously they don't have to get approval to shoot on their own location.
Mm-hmm.
So they gave us full permission to shoot drone inside everything else. So we were shooting with the drone on interiors and, you know, through locations that you typically would never get permission to shoot on. But one of the big challenges with shooting on a drone for us was, you know, how do you not see so much of the drone? Because our very first shoot, you know, we basically...
Especially if you're doing a full 360, right?
Yeah. Yeah, there's that tiny little challenge.
Yeah, there's like, I'm going to look up, I'm going to see a helicopter in front of me.
Yeah,
right.
Drones are already a completely accepted thing in film these days, down to the point that, you know, your tiny like $10,000 indie budget movie now has drone shots in it.
I'll tell you what, my real estate, we are selling our condo, and the real estate agent put up a website in 24 hours and had a drone shot outside of our condo.
Yeah.
It's like, it's everywhere.
Yeah, that's how prevalent it is now, which is also amazing. It's just like, you know, totally off topic.
What's that?
50-year-old women are doing
it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But it's been democratized to the point of, you know, just what he just said, where, you know, everyone is able to shoot like this now, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah.
So we, you know, we did a couple of test shoots, and, you know, just to clarify, we shot with a 7-camera rig. We used the... 360 Hero rig or Hero 360 7 camera rig.
Right. And those are just basically the small GoPros.
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
And it's got, they show me the rig. It's kind of cool. It's like a 3D printed rig, and you just slip the cameras right in there, and then you're good to go.
Yeah.
And the whole thing fits in your palm.
It's tiny. And that's actually very important to bring up. It's kind of funny that it's tiny, but it's actually very important that it's tiny. So it's a 7 camera rig as opposed to using the standard 6 camera rig that a lot of people use. And the reason why we chose that is that there's 5 cameras on the horizon line, which means that you have less distortion between the cameras on your horizon line. And so then we have our up and our down camera.
Right.
But what's so great about how small these rigs are, like what you were just saying, is that it means the distance between the sensors is really small. And that's absolutely crucial right now for us with stitching these cameras.
Okay.
Like, I won't bring up the name of it, but there was a porn shoot recently that shot with all reds. And they spent a ton of money on this rig that's like all these reds in a circle. And, you know, porn's got money to spend on this kind of stuff.
Sure.
And they've driven, let's be honest, they've driven technology quite a bit over the years. But
and VR and porn and pros are the industry right now, right?
But at the same time, they weren't thinking about the fact that the sensors of the cameras were so far
way
away.
Out. Right.
And when you have sensors on a camera so far away, and we're calling that the parallax distance between cameras is kind of what everybody's been saying lately.
Right.
It's very hard to stitch those images together.
Okay.
It's not so hard if the images are far apart from you, but as soon as anything gets close to you, it gets much harder to stitch those images together. Whereas the closer that the cameras are, they start to, and I won't say they succeed at this, but they start to behave as a single sensor a little bit better.
Right. That
which
makes
is
sense.
Really important for both stitching and for something we'll probably get into later, which is tracking.
Okay.
So so we did a couple of these tests, and we started to see that these kind of rigs worked much better.
Mm-hmm.
But the big problem was that the drone showed up so much in the shots that there was like no way to paint them out.
Right.
And we're a company that's good at painting stuff out. That's what we do.
I mean, the only thing
you
could do is probably have like a long wire so that it's smaller in the frame. But
that's actually exactly what we kind of did.
See.
It wasn't a wire, it was a rod. But see, we needed you on set sooner. That's what I'm saying. But we basically ended up putting it on a 2-foot arm.
So basically the drone is further away from the center.
Correct.
And you don't see it. Yeah.
Correct. But here's the really funny thing is we were very concerned about that.
Okay.
At first we were like, okay, we're getting this camera further and further from the drone, which is kind of atypical, first of all.
Right.
But we were also worried that it was going to affect how easy it is to fly the drone and then what it would do to the stability of the drone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you got this pendulum on there.
That would be one way of thinking about it.
Right.
However, we were completely wrong.
Oh, it stabilized it.
It stabilizes. Right. It's like a keel.
It's like a keel.
It's like
exactly.
Sailing. So right. It actually ends up stabilizing your footage so much better than you would ever expect.
That totally makes sense.
Yeah, that's what's funny is after the fact, you're like, oh, of course it does. But at the time, you're just
panicked.
Let's
make it heavier.
Yeah. 30-pound rig underneath it. Yeah. So we'll just put a cameraman under the drone. He'll be totally fine.
Yeah, exactly.
But really, it ended up making our footage so much more stable.
That's awesome.
And we really
see the learning process is great. Every time you're doing things that, okay, great.
And I mean, on top of that, you know, one of the things that even before this, you keep seeing where people, every single thing that you see project-wise was static cameras.
Right.
You know, especially if it was live action. Occasionally on something CG, you might see a little bit of a move. But, you know, even 6-8 months ago, everything was static almost.
Yeah, and then basically what you proved to people is like, okay, not only did I break the barrier, I'm not a static camera, I'm moving. I'm on a drone, so there I've broken that problem down, and then I'm stereo because I'm converting it afterwards. So you've basically said I've been able to come over all these technical problems.
Right. It's an interesting conversation I actually just had with Dan Gregoire over at Halon, who was one of my previous bosses, and he started his own VR company now.
Yeah.
But I just had this conversation with him, and it was that a lot of these problems to date had been dealt with by engineers and by programmers, not so much by people in production.
Right.
And so in production, we're so used to just basically just marching forward and trudging forward on a problem and problem solving it, not looking at what the obvious problems necessarily are and saying we're going to avoid those because we haven't solved that yet technologically.
Sure.
And just saying, let's give it a shot and then let's get some footage and see what we're able to deal with out of it. And I'm not saying fix it in post, but I am saying that let's deal with the limitations that we have and go ahead and try to march forward and see how we can best address them and still get the shots we want.
Exactly.
And I think that that's one of the things that this project proved successful on is that, you know, at the end of the day, you end up flying through an agave field where you go from being at ground level on the very first shot to shooting 30 feet in the air within the first 20 seconds of the piece, and people love it.
Right. Like,
and then you start traveling forward between two rows of agave plants, and we literally take you right inside of a truck.
Right.
Inside of a truck from there. So in our first shot, we've broken so many rules of VR.
Of course.
And yet people are totally into it.
Yeah. No, it totally makes sense. It totally makes sense. And I love the idea of what it is. Now, you did mention some interesting things to me about how now that basically let's just call this. You have a fairly stable shot because of the keel. The keel, we'll call it the keel effect.
Sure.
And then we'll have some footage, but now you basically still only have a stereo a single image.
Correct.
And there's several things that you guys did to convert that into a stereo that were really interesting in that process. So let's break some of those down because those are interesting as well.
Sure. So, you know, basically we walk away from that, let's say that shot specifically where you were just talking about. And what we do is, you know, I was responsible for the shoot on set. So I was managing the cameras, all the cards coming out of the cameras, everything else. We do a quick stitch of it where we don't even bother with like the full, making sure every camera is synced because we are dealing with GoPros here. There's not easy to perfectly
like
sync them.
Right,
You know, a lot of these things are going to change so fast. So I'm not going to focus on those.
I'm sure next gen is going to start to have a little more pro features on them.
Yeah, but. What we did is we initially would do a very quick stitch of that and hand it to the director. So I had it in the director's hands with the Oculus in 10 minutes from the time he would choose his select. So boom, he would have a select. Let's take a look at that in the Oculus. So that way you don't move company before you're ready.
Sure. Cuz
that's our biggest concern on a real live action shoot is you don't want to walk away not knowing if you really got the shot or if you think you got the shot and actually everything was perfect except for it's just like any film scenario where an extra is like staring at the camera.
Right.
You know, and we actually did have that happen on this.
Sure.
So and we were able to catch that where we thought we had our select and we were able to show him the quick stitch and then he'd say, "Oh, wait, nope. Can't use that one, you know?
Right.
So we had those kind of things happen. So you've got that stitch. So you say, we've got our circle take.
Okay.
And then let's pretend we've gone to post now.
Okay.
So that happens. We get back to the studio. We have our circle take. We take all the cameras. We sync them properly. We now do an initial stitch with them, which this is where we get into some of the things you were talking about, where everybody, well, not everybody, but a lot of people, especially at the consumer level or prosumer level, are using some of the off-the-shelf solutions.
Sure.
be it Video Stitch, Color, you know, one of those kinds of pieces of software. Mm-hmm. We actually have an in-house dev team that wrote an algorithm for placing the cameras inside of a sphere in Nuke.
Okay.
So it's actually very similar to some of the tools that the Foundry showed at, I believe at CES. Was that when they showed it?
Yep.
So it's kind of similar to that concept. So we have that, and we have our initial, that's what we call our procedural stitch.
Okay.
And from there, we do our own version of a track, which the big difference for us is we're not tracking the individual cameras, or we're not tracking a cubic six pack or anything like that. We're actually tracking the lat long image.
You're tracking a full 360.
Correct. Right. Yeah. So we're tracking the 360 by 180 all the way.
Mm-hmm.
And what's great about that is that you end up with a single track solution that you can then add CG elements to.
Right.
Which there's lots of those in this Patron piece.
Right. But and then there is additional stabilization that you still need to do. Right.
Yes. So that's where that kind of goes hand in hand with the other part. So that tracking we call S-Track, which is spherical tracking.
Okay.
So we have our own little plugin we wrote for Nuke for that.
Right.
Then its sister app is what we call R-Kill, which is Rotation Killer. So most people think of things in terms of stabilization. We actually went way past the idea of stabilization. Again, kind of going back to probably the metric that most people can compare it to with Video Stitch or with Color, is they do the kind of mocap sensibility of they look at the curve and they get rid of the peaks and valleys and they smooth it out, you know, or my favorite from Motion Builder, Butterworth, for anybody who knows that one. So, so instead of doing that, we actually declare the horizon line and then we have a completely rotation-free version of the spherical image. So north stays north the entire time. There's no roll, there's no pan, there's no tilt.
It's kind of like the compass on a boat where the
the
sphere always stays stable.
Yes.
And you're basically seeing what horizon is, and it's always going to just rotate the entire spherical world so that it all sort of lines
exactly.
up.
That's exactly what it is.
Uh-huh.
So we do that with our footage right out of the gate off of our initial stitch.
Okay.
And the great thing about that is we've got this track now, and we've got this R-Kill or this stabilization, probably the easiest way to term it for people that haven't seen it, because it's pretty wild. But what we do from there is we can now add our own moves in post to it.
Right, because we can make it look left, look right,
exactly.
or whatever.
Exactly. We can add them to taste, which is, I think, what's great is, you know, we can add things that we can try to get aggressive in post and then watch it and say, okay, did we take that too far? Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm pretty seasoned at this point. You know, I've been dealing with VR for a couple of years, almost 3 years now, and, like, if it doesn't make me sick, doesn't really mean a whole lot, but if it doesn't make our intern sick, we're doing something right.
Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, we can use those
fresh
as gauges.
So they don't get
jaded. Yeah. But we have used this for a couple of other purposes too, which one of the ones that I really love about it is that we can use this to do a post move on it, which is what we're calling an extract.
Okay.
So you can make a 16:9 ad out of a VR piece.
Oh, right, of course.
Because you can shoot another camera inside of that camera.
Right. You're basically just, it's like doing a CG render of a 360, you know, HDR or whatever.
Correct. That's exactly what it is. Now, I mean, there are some resolution limitations depending on what you captured and how you captured it, but
what was the final resolution that you had of that Patron piece when you stitched it all together?
It was 4K by 2K at 60 frames per second.
So that's pretty good.
Each individual camera we did at the, I wish we could have done it at the 4K resolution per camera.
Yeah, but I don't think they do 60.
They don't do 60. That's exactly the problem. So we did it at 1920 by 1440. So we did 4x3, which gave us a little bit better overlap. Between cameras, which we actually utilize that to our advantage quite a bit, that extra bit of information.
Gotcha.
So,
okay. So you've stabilized the footage, you've got it, and then at this point, now you can track it. And then you're able to actually extract your 3D in the same kind of way that you've done in the past, or?
Combination.
Okay.
So we do our track, which is basically point cloud generation that comes from using the other two methods.
Okay.
So they all kind of go hand in hand, which is really nice. So it's not like you have to do one, then the other. They actually all kind of come out together. Because our devs were working together on those, that basically you run it through, and it's very similar to, say, you know, how you would track something in Synthize. You know, you'd pick your features and everything else.
Yep.
Most feature tracking works that way, but we, you know, we have some automated portions of it, and then somewhere we add our own features. Same general concept, but we have kind of an output that comes from there that will give you a fully stabilized version of the plate, mm-hmm. a free version of the plate that gives you information on the rotations, and then if you want to filter it.
Right.
And then from there, we then add in sample 3D objects to show that the track works well. So okay. that's where we basically take that render, we export that lat long to an image sequence that we then bring over to Maya, put right on a sphere in Maya, mm-hmm. export that camera from our plugin in Nuke, and now we have a Maya scene
right.
that is just like if you were to export a camera track,
gotcha.
And you're now ready to start adding
and
your
like,
CG
all right,
elements.
Let's put a cube in there. Let's yep. do this and see how it works. Okay, yep. great.
And then as far as us business model-wise, if we're doing the CG work ourselves, we would just jump straight in. If we're handing that off, like on the Patron project, we actually were handing that off for Firstborn to do the CG elements.
Okay.
We would give them a pre-prepped Maya scene with,
here's your camera.
With V-Ray shader set up.
Yeah.
And then they would basically be able to just add whatever their elements were, but we would put a couple of temp elements because they would say, okay, we're going
to
go into this doorway.
So you need to
so
know
I would
where
add the
it.
Doorway for right. it. So that way they're not just opening up a Maya scene not knowing what's going on.
Right,
so some
right.
of it's the software, some of it's us being a good, I guess, vendor.
Sure.
So.
So you guys were basically, Firstborn was actually doing the CG themselves, and they rendered it in V-Ray. For there are certain elements. Obviously, there's impossible moves that you're doing. And
yes, yes.
So there's certain CG elements that are done, and they were able to integrate it because you guys had a fully tracked area, and you could just place
correct.
It in the scene. Yeah.
Correct. So I would actually put a ground plane in, and then I would put elements on all four major, like north, south, east, west,
mm-hmm.
and then wherever I knew they were going to add CG, I would put a couple of guide elements there, and
right.
then I would render a wireframe from V-Ray,
right.
and then comp that over and send it over as a quick time with the Maya file.
Okay.
So that way they know they're getting a solid track.
Now at that point, when you were rendering the 3D, that was not rendered in stereo 3D, right? You
correct.
Did a conversion.
Yeah,
again.
Everything is mono up to this point.
Right.
Stereo has not even entered the conversation yet.
Right. So you are still doing a 3D in this one, right? You have a
yes.
question, Steven?
No.
We're getting
I should I should note to anyone listening. Steven is who's just joined the company. He's working with us and he's in the room. But he's been working away trying to get all kinds of V-Ray stuff installed and working and on his new system and everything. And every now and then he catches ear in terms of an interest. And I was like, I think Steven's interested in hearing about some of this stuff. So he's kind of enjoying some of this conversation. And we'll do a podcast with him soon. He promises me. Anyway, okay, so let's go back. So basically, you've done everything. You've converted the whole thing. At this
yep.
point, you're going to treat the stereo the way you've treated everything, and that whether
yep.
it's CG or live action, you're going to treat the stereo as a conversion process.
Well, we are, but I should probably clarify something here as far as how conversion works for CG elements.
Okay.
We have a very specific pipeline for that.
Well, you can get more out of the CG, so it's probably a little bit more guided, right? Or
more than that, actually. It's,
okay.
it's a whole different process. So, you know, let's say we've done exactly what I just talked about.
Sure.
We handed it off. They've added a B in, and they've added a CG room in
sure.
to some part of it. So they'll render those elements in V-Ray, same as you would for any kind of spherical V-Ray render.
Mm-hmm.
So it is using the spherical camera from V-Ray, just to
yep.
clarify that, in Maya. And so when they render it, I always ask for a Z-depth pass.
Well, that makes sense.
Yes.
Yes,
so
of course.
The Z-depth pass, we
which
actually...
Which you can't normally get out of a live action. You have to guesstimate what the Z-depth is.
Exactly.
Right?
So what we do in our conversion is, on any live action is we end up creating... A depth pass that looks like a Z-depth pass.
Sure.
So it's the same kind of a thing
yep.
that we're creating.
Right.
So if we get that as a Z-depth pass from CG, we then just mix it in with ours,
with
and
else.
It's just like doing
and
that. So I don't need a left and right render.
Right.
So
and
I think
right,
that's the biggest thing to clarify is I don't need a left and a right eye from
no.
from a CG render. All I need is your CG render plus a Z-depth pass,
right.
and then I can place it in depth.
And you can comp in Z-depth and right in Nuke, right?
Exactly. So,
yeah.
Yep.
Then,
and that's exactly what we do.
Exactly.
So,
okay, that makes sense. And
yep.
then you basically just say, okay, project, done.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's really cool, and that was the first time that I got introduced to what you guys are doing. You sort of came up to me and you said, check this thing out. This is kind of what we're doing. It's like, oh, yeah, how did I get that camera to do that? And so I was kind of interested in that, and you told us that, like, now I'm about to do this big project that is an all-CG project, so
yeah.
now that's the next step.
Yep.
Where you want to not even deal with the conversion aspect of it. You want to do
right.
it all in stereo.
Right.
And we were very new, as most of the listeners will know at this point, that the whole stereo VR stuff for us was actually kind of a new thing. And you got in touch with Lotto
mm-hmm.
and said, hey, this is what I want to do, and here's the kind of problems I need to solve. So a lot of the, I should say that a lot of the new stuff that people are doing, and they're looking at the stereo VR stuff, a lot of that initial guidelines and where we've developed it so far has been initiated by you, to be honest. So that's one of the things I want to know. You know, when you basically, people say, oh, you guys are so helpful with helping us out. It's like, you have no idea, because we would never have done it if it wasn't for your need for that. So that is, to us, like all the other users should realize, like, if you want something to happen, don't be shy to ask, because not only do you benefit yourself, but you benefit everyone else, including us, to be able to give it to everyone else. So that conversation, because you already knew the problems, you already knew all the things we had to deal with. So to us, the conversation is, oh, great. He's doing something really cool. I know what he's trying to do. If I just go in there and say, here it is, what do you think? I don't know. But you can go in and it's like, no, I need this, this, and this. You've solved like 6 months of development in terms of solving those problems.
Which the is user case problems.
The user case problems, right? So we need to know what the user cases are and what we need to do to make this work. So specifically, it's like, okay, the idea of slitting every eye, every pixel, so that it works between everywhere you look, that's an important problem to solve. And that was some of the one thing that was really interesting to solve. The other one that I didn't even realize, I had a conversation with Vlado, is the poles.
Oh, yeah.
So tell me, I'm going to let you talk about poles, but I was like, oh, of course that makes sense. So tell them we've already discussed, I'm going to assume that people have figured out that basically you have to render left and right eye, and as you rotate your head, it's a slightly different stereo for every pixel as you're rotating your head.
It's not nodal. It's the biggest thing to say. There's a positional change for both eyes.
Right.
Right.
So positional change for both eyes as you're rotating around, but you can, because it's a ray tracer, you can ray trace that difference, and it looks like a smooth image on both sides.
Right.
And it's actually pretty interesting. But if I'm looking north, let's just say, and I look straight up, then the stereo is going to work. The minute I rotate my head, it's not going to work.
Right.
Because the minute I look up, the eyes are left and right, and I can render that. But if I turn my head 90 degrees, the eyes are like top bottom. So that doesn't work.
I think the best way to kind of spell that out isn't so much the poles, which poles have their own issue, but that's actually related to tilting your head. So if you were to tilt your head side to side, so if you try to touch one ear to your shoulder,
Stereo is ruined.
Well, it is on this pre-rendered situation.
Right.
The game engines deal with it as those cameras are live. So you don't really have poles and you don't have a tilt problem.
Right.
We have that problem currently with baked-in narrative storytelling, but we won't always have that problem.
No, not in a full, real-time 3D environment.
Well, you don't even have to have a real-time environment, actually. Right. You just need to have a depth map that you can plug in real-time.
Okay.
That's the big kind of, I think, where we're going to change even further from this is like what I was just talking about with the Z-depth for CG elements.
Right.
We're going to get to a point, I feel like, where these things could be, and Chris, you guys please solve this for us.
Okay.
We would really appreciate that.
Yeah.
But if we render everything in one image, and then you also feed in the depth map into a player that now feeds that to each eye separately, and it recreates the image per eye based on that depth map. If you have that, now I can tilt my head, I can look straight up, I can look straight down. We can do anything we want then and maintain stereo throughout.
Right.
So I think
there are other solutions actually as well, which we can get to in a bit. but yeah, that is thing. But one thing to keep in mind, when you're doing like the stereo 360 images, What V-Ray does, and a lot of other renderers do that as well, is they gracefully de-stereoize it as you go up. So as you're looking up, you're actually just looking at a flat image.
Yeah, we call it a stereo fall-off.
Stereo fall-off.
Yeah.
And yet, what's cool is that you can actually, there's a control in V-Ray for those, and basically says, oh, at this angle, start to fall it off, and by the time you get to this angle, there's no stereo. So it's like you said, a fall-off.
Yep.
And it actually works pretty well.
It does.
But you should be aware of it when you're doing renders, and don't put yourself in a tight space, because then the ceiling and the floor look very distorted as you look up and down. If you're in an outdoor space or in a large space, it plays just fine.
I love that you just said don't put yourself in a tight space to me.
Yeah.
Because let's talk about my next project that we just did.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
So we did the Beware Crimson Peak project
right.
For for Legendary.
Yeah.
And we,
director is Guillermo del Toro.
Guillermo del Toro directed the film.
And
yes.
I got to say, I saw it. I didn't know that that's what you were doing, but I saw the teaser for this a while ago, and I was like, oh, they're bringing back classic horror films.
Oh, yeah.
Like hardcore classic horror
Absolutely.
Films. Old Haunted Mansion.
Absolutely.
Just gorgeous.
Yes.
Creepy, gross, nasty stuff. Yeah.
Well, and you know, they built the entire mansion.
Oh, really?
For that project. Yeah. Like, and it's to scale, fully functional. They built it specifically for the film.
Yeah, because CG
sucks. I mean,
it
helps to be... it helps to be Guillermo del Toro. But,
of course, no.
But the interesting thing about what you were just saying is don't put yourself in these tight spaces.
Right.
And the concept behind this piece is that you're traveling down one of these very small hallways
right.
inside of the mansion.
Right.
And it actually works very well.
It does.
Now, we did have to deal with that stereo fall-off issue that you right. were just talking about. And so
but
we did
have
to
fairly
dial it
well.
In.
I mean, I didn't notice it. And the fact is, that, okay, here's the thing. Not many people look straight up. When you're going down a hallway in a horror film, right?
Right.
You're not going, ooh, let me look at the ceiling. You know, yep. you're like, oh, shit, where am I going? Right?
Something's
going
to happen Something's in front of you or right behind you.
Right behind you. And there's, and yeah, and you're waiting for it, and that's what's supposed to be. Yeah.
Right.
So it was a really cool thing, and it was all – and it was the first – your first foray is like, okay, let's try this technology out and make it work.
Right.
And at the same time, you had you know, some assets obviously you guys got from Mr. X, I believe, right?
Yeah, I should probably give that a little bit of a preface. But
yeah.
So the idea was that, you know, they wanted us to do a VR project,
yep.
you know, specifically for this for Comic-Con.
Uh-huh.
And so they got us in touch with Mr. X and – said, okay, you know, what have you done for the film that would hold up for something like this?
Okay.
And so, you know, we've got a great relationship with Mr. X, and
yep.
so we've actually worked with them in the past already.
Yeah, they
and
do so, a bunch of movies that probably did a lot of conversion before.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we already knew who to talk to and
exactly.
everything else, and so
yep.
we got in touch with them and said, hey, you know, do you have something that might work good for this? And so they gave us their elements, which is great,
mm-hmm.
and I should preface that they were already prepped for V-Ray, which was a big part of why you and I are having this conversation.
Yes.
And so we got their elements, and I put together a little previz. And what happened was when Legendary told us about it and they said, let's get you in touch with Mr. X to talk about it, everything else, we came back, and I think they were expecting, you know, just like, here's what we want to do, and I gave them a full previz.
You give in the Oculus?
In the Oculus,
right.
yeah.
Nice.
And huge thank you to Mr. Andrew Hazelden for
uh-huh.
that, because if it weren't for him and PlayBlast VR,
really?
I don't know if I'd be sitting here right okay. now. So genuine, honest shout
wow,
out
so you're
right
able
there
to play
too.
Blast right into
yes,
the Oculus.
Yeah. So
wow.
That was massive for me. So
okay.
I know you guys have worked with Andrew
uh-huh.
a little bit on some other things as well.
Right.
And I don't know if this would have happened initially without him and then after that without you guys.
Okay. No, well, it was really, really cool. And I actually really like the fact that you there's some effects that you guys did with Phoenix, which is like, oh, wow. And it,
yeah.
not that that has any effect on the VR, but it's like, yeah, you guys were using Phoenix too. So
oh, absolutely.
Cool.
It,
yeah.
it has an effect on the VR. Like it was very important for us because...
Well, in terms of, yes, the visuals, but
yeah.
in terms of the rendering portion of it, I don't
yeah.
think it necessarily made a big difference for...
Oh, like render time or render...
Well,
what do
just
you mean?
Like... I mean, you basically just did this effect, right? And,
yeah.
And it worked really well with V-Ray, which is great. So
yep.
those things are really cool. But yeah... It's so I don't want to give too much away about it, about the actual piece, because
yeah.
that's part of the surprise and the excitement
yeah,
of it.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
And we should also note that you guys are going to be coming to hang out with us at SIGGRAPH, which
yep.
is part of the reason we're going to try to get this podcast out, and give people a preview of what this is. And we mentioned it in the last podcast that we're going to have something we call the VR Bar, where we're going to be showcasing a bunch of interesting content
mm-hmm.
being done in VR. And so... people can definitely come by and check you out and see what you guys are doing and talk to you about your process, because I think that would be really cool for you guys to learn from what Justin has done. But more importantly, I want people to experience the Crimson piece. And if you allow us to film you while you're watching it, and if you do the exact same thing that I did, which is jump out of my seat in fear and practically yank the whole VR headset off my head, then you guys have done a good job. So and it did. It's very effective. And you're like, oh, I get it. And so it's a really cool experience to see that. And I loved what that is. So
And on the really live action side of things, you know, mixed with CG, we're super excited to show the Patron piece.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that that's something that, you know, everybody's still kind of scratching their heads on is how do you deal with live action CG mix? And it's something we've dealt with and are continuing to deal with and improve on, but it's exciting.
And so I should also know that you were telling me about this stuff, and I said, oh, I would love to show it to Kesa to you. I said, great. So I wanted to go meet you over at Legend 3D, and you told me. And you and I ended up talking for at least an hour and a half.
Because
it was very clear that, like, we both have very passionate ideas about what this actually means. What is it all going to be, and where is it going to go? And there's a lot of the implication of what VR is, and this is going to be an ongoing conversation. And we may, when we have conversations about VR, I may ask you back to be a moderator and part
of
this.
Oh, would love to.
Because this is
what
it is. It's like, let's talk about what it is, because we're now basically creating a whole new medium. And I know that's been said like a million times, but the new medium means so much on so many different ways and what it is. So what a lot of people do in terms of the VR experience is trying to find thrills, right? Like, first thing I'm going to do is going to ride a roller coaster, right?
Right.
Well,
roller coaster VR, I mean, that's like the main downloaded app still. Like,
right,
it is,
of course.
Yeah,
so. And so that's what you're going to do. Did you ever see, if you haven't seen this movie called Brainwave?
Yeah, I've seen Brainwave.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Do you know who directed that movie?
No.
Doug Trumbull.
Oh, there you go.
And it's, you know, obviously Christopher Walken.
Yep.
And Natalie Wood's last movie. She died after that movie was made, which is interesting because she dies.
With Christopher Walken, yes. If I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's basically the story of the movie, for those who haven't seen it, is the fact that they find a way to record your brainwaves onto, at that time, reel-to-reel tape, like some kind of metallic tape, optical tape, or I think it's like whatever, it's tape. And once you've recorded it, whatever you experienced during that time, you could play it back and that person could experience it. And whether it is something you're experiencing live or it's a memory that you have and you're thinking about the memory, you can play back your memory to someone or whatever it is. But the funny thing is, they're like, when I just watched the trailer to it again, because I was talking about it, and I was like, seeing them play that just and doing their pitch to their investors looks exactly like every VR company today giving their pitch to the investors. Here we go. We're going to be riding a roller coaster. Now I'm in a kayak going whitewater rafting. It's like, it's the same content. It's all exactly the same kind of stuff. Course. And of course there's like the gratuitous sex scene that also happens in there, because you have to experience sex in a
heart attack having sex.
No, he does not have a heart attack having sex. Actually, just we'll put an explicit rating on here, but basically what happens is that this young guy who does all the thrill riding, he's the content guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's a thrill seeker. He puts on a headset and goes on roller coasters, whitewater rafting, etc. Ends up having sex with this girl, right? And he records it secretly, and then he gives it to the old guy who is like one of the engineers on it. He's like, hey, I recorded this for you. Check it out. I had sex with this young girl. You can check it out. And the guy looks at it, you know, in VR mode or whatever, and takes the climax part of the recording and loops it, makes a loop out of it, and basically plays it to himself over and over again till he ends up in a coma from basically climaxing every 10 seconds. So that's what the whole idea of what that was, which is a very interesting idea. It's like, I think that's a brilliant, weird thing of like doing this over and over and over.
Strange Days kind of hit on a lot
of
these
Strange Days does
well.
This kind of stuff as well. But the idea is like the content is always like thrill seeking and sex, right? That is basically the only thing that people are focused on. And now what you've done is a couple other things. One is the Patron piece is very lighthearted.
Yeah.
It is not thrill seeking. It's fun and light. And
it's actually educational, which is the funny part. I mean, it's educational about tequila. We're not talking about like grade school educational, but it is literally educational on how you make tequila.
Right.
Like, that's
and you get to be, you know, the joke is I'm a fly on the wall or a bee on the wall, right?
Yeah.
So you get to be experienced and it's like, oh, it's great. And you don't feel, it's not nauseating in any way, shape or form. It's very free flow. It's an experience. It's educational, et cetera. And it sort of brings up the idea of what we were talking earlier at lunch about documentaries,
right?
where you get to experience something in a new way. So I think the medium with which people are doing VR is something that is, there needs to be something new, a new way of finding medium, a new way of doing things in VR, which I think that's something we still haven't figured out.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've heard me talk a little bit about the documentary side of things. And, you know, I actually haven't been involved in a documentary piece to date yet,
right.
Which I really hope to change that very soon, mainly because I feel like we're going to change some ways in which you tell story. Like you kind of said, thrill-seeking is thrill-seeking, you know, orgasms are orgasms.
Right.
Like that stuff's not going to change that much. The way in which you can experience a minute in a new and a fresh way
right.
is always going to be exciting and good.
Right.
And it's also, let's be honest, it's good for the medium. Like it's going to push it.
Sure.
But at the same time, there's certain areas that I think are a bit more game-changing than others.
Sure.
I feel like in some ways this can be a much bigger game changer for documentary,
mm-hmm.
for educational purposes, for training purposes. I think those are some things where it really pushes into areas that those have never had the benefit of,
right.
or maybe even the honesty of, which is one of the things I kind of talked to you about documentary is, documentary to date, and let's be honest, a lot of documentary is propaganda in some way or another,
of course.
Even if you agree with it or don't agree with the
right.
propaganda that it's pushing. But it's going to present you with a very particular, traditional documentary is going to present you with a very particular image. They're
mm-hmm.
going to give a very specific view of what's going on in that space at that time.
Right.
And they're going to make sure that it tells their story.
Right.
That they want it to tell, not that it tells on its own.
Right.
Whereas if you are now in a VR space and you are being told someone's life story that, say, has cancer and it's a child
mm-hmm.
that has cancer and is dealing with the everyday implication of this, and they're telling you what's going on with them and how it feels to be a child dealing with these things,
mm-hmm.
and if you were viewing this in the way you typically view most documentaries, which like I said to you earlier, is usually on your laptop, not even on a real television,
right.
you can look away and now you're in whatever space you're in, and whether it's lighthearted or you have an escape, I guess
it's
probably the most important
thing. A visual
thing.
Escape, right?
Visual escape, and especially if you're not in the room alone, you can then talk to someone and now you're in kind of your safe space.
Right.
Whereas if you were in that same space and this, let's get young with it. Let's like an 8-year-old that's dealing mm-hmm. with chemo or something like that, and they're talking to you and they're talking about what it's like to throw up every day and they've lost all their hair and none of their friends are visiting them because mm-hmm. they have school or whatever is going on, and you look away, but now when you look to the right, you're looking at their brother or their sister sitting in the chair next to them, and
yeah.
their entire family is there with them. You can't get away from that moment.
Right.
That is as real as that moment could be without actually being there.
Right.
And to me, like, that changes the essence of what documentary can be.
Yeah, that's a brilliant way of looking at it. And I think it's amazing because I love that story. I think it's a really good story, and it basically makes it hard. It's easier just to look away from your screen. It's much harder
yep.
to say, okay, stop, take this thing off my head.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you can't really do that.
Your reaction. Your reaction as a human is to look away.
Right.
So if you look away, you're still there. You're still in the room with them. And if you then mix in directional audio with that, now if you look away and you turn to your right and you're seeing their family member, but they're talking at you and you're still hearing them from your left ear.
Right.
I mean, that taps into a part of your brain that accepts that as real.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It was interesting because, as a lot of you guys know, there's a group of guys that are part of what we're calling the Digital Film League, and I had a dinner with them yesterday because a bunch of them have had some great stuff. So Roy Robinson was one of them, Ben West is one of them, and Kevin Marger. All three of those have been on the podcast before, and they're all directors, and they've all been interested in the VR stuff. Especially Ben, for example, he works over at Framestore, and they do mm-hmm. a bunch of VR stuff there too.
Oh yeah,
and he's we were talking about, as a director, the challenges of VR and mm-hmm. what it really is and what it is to tell a story in VR. And, one of the things directors love are close-ups, but what is a close-up in VR?
Yeah.
And how do you make a close-up in VR? Because a close-up on the screen is cool and beautiful and wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets really see the emotions and the eyes and everything. But in VR, it's like I'm just awkwardly close to this person. And
right.
like, that's very weird. Like, I wouldn't want to have a close-up of Steven in VR. I think it would be very awkward.
He hasn't worked here very long yet, so let him work here a little longer. Maybe it'll be okay.
But the idea of what a close-up is, and then other technical questions, mm-hmm. everyone's like, oh, you can't do depth of field in VR. It's like, really? Okay, why not? Can you? Can you not? Does it matter? Does it make a difference? How does that work? Because I've obviously seen in stereo, I've seen depth of field, right?
So, and I mean the BBC stuff. Kingdom stuff that we showed you as
well. The Kingdom stuff, beautiful.
Oh my God.
You guys worked on Ant-Man too, right?
Yeah, well, we did the trailer for it. I'm not sure if we did shots for the
film
itself.
Okay, but the trailer of the train sequence obviously had a bunch of...
Yeah, that was all us, but yeah.
That was a lot of depth of field, and it worked in stereo, so why wouldn't it work in VR?
That's interesting. You hit on multiple topics there, but
but you know what I mean. I'm not asking you to answer any of these questions, because basically all I'm doing right now is I'm saying these are just questions I came up in 5 minutes.
Yeah,
and they're each one of them deserves hours of analysis.
Absolutely.
And just like you were dealing with, you know, how do I shoot something, and do I shoot it in a single camera? Do I do this, and how do I explain this? So now I deal with the poles. Okay, so now I can do this technology. Cannot deal with the poles. Doesn't really matter because the poles are seen like 10% or 5% of the time.
Right.
And then, you know, just going through all of these answers, what is a close-up? What's a cut in VR? Can you cut in VR?
Yeah,
can
absolutely.
You fade in VR? Obviously, like when
you
I see...
You can fade. I know that one for sure.
Okay.
I've done that multiple times.
You can fade in VR.
Yes. Fading is fine. Hard cutting is quite difficult.
Right.
I wouldn't say it's impossible.
No.
I think this gets into a little bit of the conversation that we had earlier about just kind of where we are with VR,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, 6 months ago, we were in the Lumiere Brothers days of this,
right.
where, you know, you had people that came into a theater because they heard about this footage, quote unquote, that was captured, you know, from a camera, borrowed from Thomas Edison or something like that. And so, you know, these people would buy these tickets and come in, and this train would go by on a static shot, and they'd run out of the theater thinking they were going to get run over by a train. I mean,
and that is not even stereo.
Yeah. We're talking about,
and it's probably playing at about 8 frames a second.
And we're not terribly far beyond that as far as where we are with VR right now. We're still very experimental. You know, the reason why I've had a couple people, you know, ask me where I think we are, and for some reason I keep putting us somewhere in the 70s. And the reason is that was right when we started to learn how to use a Steadicam.
Right.
And so, like, kind of just before and right into the Steadicam days.
Right.
And that changed filmmaking a lot.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's kind of where we are. And the main reason why I think I latch onto that is the whole how we dealt with a moving camera on the drone.
Sure.
And then having to, like, the drone itself wasn't even enough, because the drone and footage by itself was making people sick.
Right.
We had to come up with a method. That whole R-Kill thing we did wasn't just because we knew we wanted to do that. It was because the footage would have been unusable otherwise.
Of course. It made you sick. Like,
yeah,
blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. It was a necessity due to the limitations of what we had to shoot with.
Yep.
And so, you know, we are in that with a lot where it's like, okay, I've decided that I can fade, and I'm very comfortable with the fading.
Mm-hmm.
But when can I fade? How can I fade? You know, it's just like, you know, if you were to go read, you know, The Eye is Quicker or one of the other great editing books out
mm-hmm.
there and see about, like, editing rules for traditional film.
Right.
We have whole new editing rules for this.
Absolutely.
You know? And time passes so differently when you're in VR.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because when I ask people, does it pass slower or faster? Almost everyone says slower. But yet if you ask them piece by piece when they're watching it, it's not that. It literally is variable depending on the type of project you're watching. Some projects feel longer than they are. Some projects
mm-hmm.
feel shorter, just like they do in film. But in film, we've gotten pretty standardized with how we cut. So it's gotten somewhat normalized there. Whereas with VR, we're not there yet at all.
Yeah.
And so some pieces feel much longer than they are. Some feel much shorter. And sometimes that's just due to the content, whether it makes you uncomfortable or whether you don't enjoy watching or whether it's boring. Let's be honest. There's a lot of VR content that's not exciting.
And a lot of the good stuff that, you know, obviously I think, and not to say that what you guys did was wrong, because I think it's the logical thing to do, but almost every VR experience I have, especially anything that's a playback of some kind, is a ride, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's either the roller coaster, because you're going down straight camera, or it's the bead traveling for Patron, or it's, you know, the Crimson Peak one. It's all this forward moving stuff. Both Patron and Crimson Peak makes sense that there's a camera moving forward, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have to do that because the whole idea is that you are traveling through this process and you're learning the whole idea. But how, what if you don't want to travel forward? What if you want to do something else?
Maybe there's some similarity to that, and this is off the cuff, but maybe there's some similarity to that and the fact that most of our hero action in films takes place from left to right.
Okay.
Just like
yes.
in reading, and most yes. villain action takes place from right to left.
Okay.
It's not an, it, by no means is that an overall rule, but a lot of films use that. Majority of films use that. And so Das Boot kind of helped push that overall mentality.
Right.
And so now it's like VR, maybe when you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, you're always traveling forward. Maybe when it's awkward or wrong, and the Insurgent piece actually has you travel backwards a little bit, and that is when something's going wrong. So maybe that's our equivalent there.
Right.
I don't know.
It could be. I mean, there's all, you know, obviously the rules, you know, the other rules of editing is the 180 rule, right? So you can't cross the plane. So you have for those who may not know about editing, but you basically sort of have to imagine in front of the camera, somewhere in front of the camera is a plane where the action takes place along that plane, being a dialogue piece where one person is on one side of the plane and the other person is on the other side. And you can film them as long as you never cross that plane. So that therefore, if you have someone talking and you see the right side of their face, the reverse shot, you'll see the other person's left side of their face.
Imagine you're the third person sitting at the table.
Exactly. And Jean Godard loves to break those rules.
Yep.
And so he'll shoot in one of my favorite, one of his films, he does called Masque d'un Criminel. He'll shoot the guy and he'll shoot the girl completely reverse, and normally you could catch it immediately, but the movie is so confusing the whole time on purpose, still has a great story, that you're just sitting there going, this is a really weird conversation, and they're really just talking about what they're going to do tonight, and like, I'm so confused, what are they doing? And all he's done is just mess with the editing style, right?
Yeah.
And that's called the invisible style. That was invented back in the film noir days, and where they basically, editing became something you weren't even conscious of. Before that, it was all just long takes, cut, next scene, long take, cut, next scene.
And that's kind of where we are with VR.
Yeah.
Instead of long take, cut, it's long take, cross dissolve, next scene, long take, cross dissolve.
Right.
And we're very much in that right now. And
yeah.
I don't think it's so much that the cutting or that even getting more into the conversational style will be entirely wrong as that our viewers and even us as filmmakers right now, we're not ready to do it yet.
Right.
I mean, we're trying, we're playing with it some for sure, but there's a lot of education of the viewer in general. And then there's also like, there's what I call getting your sea legs. Like there's this whole element of maybe I am going to orbit the camera just a little bit, which
imagine,
now is not accepted.
Imagine
at all.
If you took one of the audience members who saw the train at the station at the Lumiere Brothers film and you took him to go see Fast and the Furious, I think they would be very confused.
Exactly. Exactly.
To us, it's like completely normal that there's a cut every 12 frames, you know?
Yep. Yep.
But to them, I don't think it would make any sense.
Very
whatsoever.
Much so.
Yeah.
Very much so.
So, all right. Listen, there's a lot of great stuff to do. We're actually running a little bit long, which is perfectly fine. We will bring this back around. I'm sure we'll have a lot more content with Justin. Make sure to come see us at SIGGRAPH. Talk to Justin. He'll be there. I think you're actually going to be talking at V-Ray Days as well.
Yeah, so I'll be both at the VR bar. Yeah. So come see me there. If you can't catch me there, I will be at V-Ray Days. I believe I am on Wednesday at 2 p.m.
We will get a confirmation on that, and Gino will kill me if we get that wrong. But don't worry. We will confirm date and time. But he's going to be there talking about this process, and you can talk to him and ask him questions there as well. So lots of interesting stuff, Justin. Thank you so much. We are going to let the last bucket drop on the podcast, and we will continue to talk to Justin in the future about some VR stuff. Hope you guys enjoyed it.
Cheers.
All right. Thank you, guys. Bye.